Welcome to Musonomics from the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt. I'm Larry Miller. Several years ago, we established a series of public conversations at NYU Steinhardt about contemporary issues in music publishing, honoring the legacy of Ralph S. Peer, the founder of Peer Music. This year's Peer Lecture was a very special evening with United States Copyright Office Register Shearer Perlmutter. But first, a bit about Ralph S. Peer. As a young man, he went to work for Columbia selling records. He noted that the public was interested in something new, but a little different. He produced the 1927 Bristol Sessions, considered the big bang of country music, where he discovered Jimmy Rogers and the original Carter family, and became an innovator and leader in bringing Latin music to the world. Ralph S. Peer is in the Blues and Country Music Hall of Fame and received the Recording Academy's Trustees Award. We recorded the Ralph S. Peer lecture in front of a live audience at NYU Steinhardt. His son, legendary music publisher Ralph Peer II, said in his introduction of the moderator, "There is no one who is smarter about trying to increase the income of songwriters than David Israelite, an MPA president and adjunct professor at NYU Steinhardt. And I can certainly do no better at introducing the Register of the United States Copyright Office, Shearer Perlmutter."
I've known Shearer for a very long time. We've been friends for a long time. She's given me permission to call her Shearer tonight and not Miss Register, which I appreciate. If you look at her life's work, just in the field of government service, she has had an incredible career. If you were to look at her resume just in the field of her private sector activity, you would say she's had an amazing career. And if you only focused on what she's done in academia, you would say that she has done remarkable things in her career. Yet this is a woman who did all of those things as one person. And it's just a really remarkable record. She was appointed to be the Register in 2020. And she currently oversees a team of over 500 people and advises Congress and the executive branch on copyright policy. By definition, her office is the foremost expert on copyright in the country, but she is the foremost expert as a person on copyright in the country. She had many positions prior to this. She served as the Chief Policy Officer and Director of International Affairs at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. She also served in senior leadership roles at the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, or IFPI, Time Warner, the World Intellectual Property Organization. She began her career in the Copyright Office when she was appointed the first ever Associate Register for Policy and International Affairs. And before that, she was a law professor at Catholic University, and she also advised the Clinton administration on copyright policy. She practiced law at influential law firms, and she co-authored the leading casebook on international IP law and policy. She's a fellow at Oxford University, and she graduated from Harvard University and the University of Pennsylvania Carey School of Law. So that is an abbreviated version of her resume. And it's just such an honor for me to welcome and get to interview my friend, Shearer. So we have obviously a mix in this audience of some people that know quite a bit about what Shearer does and what her office does, and some that maybe aren't as familiar. So maybe it's best to start with you giving a little bit of a description as to what the Copyright Office does and what you think is important about your role as Register.
Well, thanks, David. Is this on? Yes, okay. Thanks, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. And thank you to the Peer family and Peer Music and to NYU. I'm really delighted to be here. The office, I think of the office as having several different hats and probably three primary ones and then some little ones on the side. First of all, we help copyright owners, we help creators protect and enforce their rights. We make it easier for them to do that. We also educate people about the copyright system, whether they're copyright owners or users, what copyright is, how they can navigate the system, and how they can get our help when they need it. And then third, equally important, at least as important, you alluded to in your introduction, we advise Congress and executive branch agencies on copyright law and policy. We do all of that with a relatively small staff and small budget compared to other agencies, but we really have a fantastic group of people who are extremely committed to the mission of promoting creativity in the United States.
You mentioned a small budget. I should probably educate folks on this aspect of Washington. She's not allowed to lobby for a bigger budget for the Copyright Office, but you all are. And it's true that the resources that she gets are not nearly enough for the important work that she does, which is why we as representatives of music publishers and songwriters are always advocating that she should be given more resources. And I encourage all of you when you interact with any of your members of Congress to tell them the same.
I might jump in just to say, unlike the Patent and Trademark Office where I used to work, they are fully fee funded. And we're only about half fee funded and half through appropriations. And we're very, very happy that we now have a budget for the rest of the year.
Yes, many of us are. So when you were appointed as register, my experience is that different registers come in with kind of their own agenda about what's most important to them or what they'd like to accomplish in the job. Tell us a little bit about what your priorities are as register and how you feel like it's going a few years into the term.
Well, it's amazing that it's already been 3 years and 3.5 years, I guess. It's gone very quickly, and we've done a huge amount during that time period. When I first came in, one of the first things I did was to put in place a new strategic plan for the next 5 years at the office. And that strategic plan had four overarching goals, and they're still very much our overarching goals. One of them is what we're calling Copyright for All, which is to make the copyright system as understandable and accessible as possible to as many members of the public as possible. And that's really been our guiding lodestar ever since. And I can talk a little bit about the ways we're trying to do that later on. Second, we are very dependent on technology. We offer services, registration services, recordation services, others as well, that these days have to be provided through digital technology. And we were behind the curve. We really had outmoded systems. So we've been engaged in a project for about the last 5 years, and it's still ongoing, to really update all of our services and then to move to a continuous development model where we don't let ourselves fall behind again. We don't want to place new systems and then 15 years later find they're completely outmoded and we have to start over again. The third element is providing objective, unbiased, expert advice on policy, and I'll talk more about that as well. And then the fourth element is enhancing our use of data. And in addition to putting in place a new strategic plan, one of the first things I did was to hire the first ever chief economist for the office. And he's now put together a team. We now have several economists. We have some data analysts and statisticians, and it's the first time the office has had that. I saw how valuable that was when I was at the Patent and Trademark Office, and it really enables us to learn a lot more about what we're doing and have the data that we can use to inform all of our policy recommendations. So I'm very pleased about that.
So this is a personal opinion of mine, but I'd be interested in your reaction to it. I've had the pleasure of knowing several registers and working with many over not just this job, but before this when I was at the Department of Justice. And my opinion is that the job is significantly harder now than it ever has been. And I think that's true for two reasons. First, the technological changes are happening at a speed unlike any we've seen before. I think that in the past, you would see technological changes come about, but they would be one at a time. They would be spaced apart. You're dealing with an exponential expansion of those kind of issues. And the second reason I say that is because I feel that for a very long time in our country's history, whenever the government would engage with copyright policy, their goal was to strengthen copyright, and that the only question was exactly how they would do it. We live in a world today where that's not necessarily true, and that if there's going to be legislating in the area of copyright, there's a real risk that we would go backward from things that had been achieved. And as an advocate for copyright, that would make your job more challenging as well. So not that you need to complain about how hard your job is, but how do you react to the idea that it's just a different job today than it was many years ago? And the challenges of both the technology and also confronting just very well-funded interests on the other side that have an economic interest in weakening copyright.
I think that's true. You put your finger on some very real changes. I'm always a little loath to say my job is harder than any of my predecessors because I'm sure theirs felt very hard for them in different ways. But I think there are a number of things that have changed. I mean, one is, as you've said, the speed of technological change is just unbelievable. And it used to take a little bit longer for these things to happen that needed to be dealt with and reacted to. And then another part of it is that the interested parties have just multiplied. It used to be, like when the 1976 Copyright Act was written, that essentially publishers and authors and libraries got together and worked out what the law should say, with some academics as well. And now you've got consumers involved. Consumers are present and involved and making a difference in the copyright system in a way they never did before. They have power that they never had before. Technology companies of all kinds, communications companies of all kinds. So we just have a plethora of interests to take into account in a way that we didn't used to. And I think because of all of that, and also because as a consequence, there's a huge amount of public attention. Copyright issues are in the press almost every day. I mean, certainly in the era of AI, but even before that. And the result of all of that is it's much harder to find solutions because you have so many interests to balance and weigh and to take into account. And also it makes it much harder to legislate. It takes, as you know very well, a long time to get any legislation through. And there's always a lot of danger that if you open up legislation, for example, we've had some people talk about opening up the section of the statute dealing with fair use to deal with AI. But once you open that up, who knows where you end up.
Well, you mentioned
One other thing, I do think there's one other piece that I've thought about a lot that I think I can say with certainty makes the job more difficult now. And that is that we've become much more of a regulatory agency. Congress has given us a lot of responsibility we didn't used to have. I need a lot of lawyers now who are experts in the Administrative Procedures Act, and that never used to be the case. With things like the Music Modernization Act, which we've had to implement and oversee the operations of in many respects, and things like the Copyright Claims Board, the new Small Claims Tribunal, which we had a year and a half to set up from scratch. So we issue regulations now at a pace that certainly wasn't the case when I was at the office in the 1990s.
Yeah. It's an interesting point when you mentioned fair use. As I mentioned it in the past, it seemed as if all legislation in the copyright area was about just how much you would strengthen copyright. You have this weird dynamic today where you have many interests of copyright that don't even want to touch the issues because of their fear that it will go in the opposite direction. I mean, fair use would be one, term of copyright would be another, statutory damages would be another. So how, you know, your job is you're the primary advisor to Congress on these issues, but how concerned are you that when they legislate in this area, it's going to be not about the best strengthening of the copyright law, but rather maybe protecting what we already have?
Well, I do worry about that. I think there was a discussion, was it 5 or 10 years ago now, about putting in place a new comprehensive revision of the entire act. And there were a lot of hearings on the Hill, a lot of discussion, and I think one of the reasons it didn't happen was because there was a lot of fear that if you try to rewrite the whole act, who knows where you're going to go, where it will lead you. But then what happened was, after a few years of essentially paralysis, we had a lot of movement, as I said, with the MMA and with the CASE Act, because there were areas where there was consensus that something needed to be done, that there was a real need. And we may start seeing that again in some areas, in some of the discussions of AI that are going on today.
Yeah, so we could spend the entire interview talking about AI, and we have to touch upon it. What I'd like to do is maybe divide the question into a couple of subsets. What you're doing within your office, talk maybe a little bit about what we think will happen with Congress, and then to the extent you're able to, about what's happening in the courts. And so starting with your office, maybe tell us a little bit about your views and priorities about what you can do with regard to the challenge of AI.
Well, it's interesting. The Copyright Act Office actually started looking at the whole issue of works of authorship created, well, I shouldn't say works of authorship, works that looked like authorship created by a computer back in the 1960s. So my predecessor, Barbara Ringer, actually wrote that it was, I'm going to paraphrase very loosely, I don't have the quote in front of me, but that the issue was always whether the elements of authorship were created by man rather than a machine. And we're still looking at that exact same determination. Now, about 5 years ago, we had our first application to register a work created entirely by a computer. The claim was it was created by an algorithm running on a computer called the Creativity Machine. And that's the case for those of you who follow this called Thaler versus Perlmutter. One of the great pleasures of my job is I get to be a named defendant in lawsuits for the first time. So we said, sorry, we're not going to register it. You have to have human authorship to have copyright protection. And Dr. Thaler sued, went to the federal district court, and the court upheld our decision and agreed with us. It's now on appeal. And I always say it's dangerous to make predictions about litigation, but I'm reasonably confident that we'll prevail, so we shall see. We then started getting some applications that have been a little more complicated because they're not brought as a test case like that one was, and they involve more of a combination of human and computer contributions. So we're having to draw lines in the examination process. And it's interesting, just as an aside, the Copyright Office in this country is unusual in that we not only register copyrighted works, which they don't do in every country, but we also examine them to determine whether they're copyrightable, which very few countries do. So we are essentially becoming a natural laboratory for finding that dividing line between human and machine authorship. And therefore, we're finding there's a lot of interest abroad in what we're doing because we're out front a bit in that area. So we've been making some decisions. I think it's interesting because there's been a lot of attention given to the decisions where we've refused to register something or where we have narrowed the claim so that it doesn't include the AI-generated content. But in fact, we also are quietly registering some other works. We have now registered over 200 works that incorporated some AI-generated content where that content was appropriately disclaimed. So that's what we're doing on the registration side. In March of last year, so about a year ago, we also launched a broad AI initiative. And the same day we did that, we issued guidance for how to register works that incorporate AI-generated content. And I should also just clarify, we're looking at works where there is some essentially separable content that is generated by the machine that if a human generated it, it would be copyrightable. So we're not talking about just using AI as a tool, which in fact in the music industry has been quite common for decades now. So we announced this initiative, we issued the guidance for how to go about registering, and we then, for several months, we held roundtables, listening sessions, meetings with individual interest groups and tech companies and creators, and listened to all of them telling us how the technology was being used and what their concerns were. And then at the end of August, we issued a notice of inquiry asking 30-some questions with subparts so that we could get public input on all the questions that we had heard about that had been discussed in these earlier meetings. We got the comment period closed in December. We got over 10,000 comments. We are just about done reading them all, and I always get asked, are you looking at them with artificial intelligence? And the answer is no, we're not that advanced, but seriously, we are reading them all with human eyes and brains. It's been very interesting to read. I can talk a little more about the issues that we're looking at. Obviously, we're still in the midst of this, so I can't yet tell you what we're going to say. But in general, we've divided it into three overall topics. One is the topic of when creative works are ingested in the process of machine learning, does that constitute infringement or does it constitute fair use? And I shouldn't say does it or doesn't it. In what circumstances would it constitute infringement and in what circumstances could it constitute fair use? And then there's related questions about how licensing would work if it's not fair use, what's feasible, how that could take place, related questions about liability. If there is some infringement, who's liable? Is it the person who puts together the data set, the developer of the AI tool, the distributor of the AI tool, or the user of the tool? So those related questions about ingestion, about input. Second group of topics have to do with what I've already talked about, which is the copyrightability of the output. In what circumstances does a human contribute enough authorship so that the resulting output is copyrightable? And then the third group of topics is relates to the issue of deep fakes. So there's been a lot of coverage about this. You've seen it from the duet that looked like it was by Drake in The Weeknd to Tom Hanks' image likeness being used to sell a dental plan and Taylor Swift on certain less savory images. The question is, should there be any kind of new law at federal level to deal with that? Because right now there's a patchwork of different state and federal laws that deal with it in different ways, but they're all different. And should we have some sort of uniform, clear, consistent federal statute? So those are the three general topics that we're looking at.
Yeah, the questions were very good, and you kept my attorneys very busy for a very long time, is one of those 10,000 comments. Are you prepared to give any kind of time frame as to when you think the office is going to be prepared to put something out?
Yeah, I'm going to give a time frame, and then I always have to say, you know, assuming that the lawyers are able to get it written in time, but the plan is to start with the deepfakes issue, the digital likeness issue, because that's the one that the Hill is already very involved in. So we've got one bill that's been introduced in the House and another that where there's a discussion draft being circulated in the Senate. So we want to make sure that we say something before it goes too far. The plan is to get that part of the report. We're basically going to issue the report in sections. The plan is to get that section of the report out this spring, so in the coming couple of months. Then we will turn to the issue of copyrightability of output, in part because that's an issue we have done so much work already because of our registration system. And then finally, we will look at the constellation of issues around input and potential liability. And that is likely to be in the fall.
Okay. We just made a little bit of news today. You know, one of the things that I think you've gotten a lot of praise for, and I don't want to call it activist, but I think there's been a sense that you've been willing to be aggressive in getting out ahead of issues. You know, one way to do your job would be to wait till you're asked questions by Congress, not step out, not be afraid to make mistakes. On the AI topic, I think the sense is that you've been very willing to try to get ahead and to be bold and to really put yourself out there as a leader on these issues, which is appreciated by many, even on people on opposite sides of the issue. I think there's a sense that they appreciate the job that you and your office are doing on that. When it comes to the legislative part, obviously we are early in Congress kind of considering what to do about AI. And one of the things that we discuss in the music industry all the time is that will music even be a factor in what Congress decides to do if they ever do anything on AI? And what's even more interesting is that the recorded music side seems to have a different set of priorities than maybe the publishing and songwriting side, and that's natural. So while a federal right of publicity may be the goal for artists and record labels, on the publishing and songwriting side, there may be more importance given to transparency in the training models or record keeping and how that goes. Do you have a sense of where you think legislation might go? And how do you recommend that copyright interests play a role in making sure that their concerns are addressed in whatever is done on AI? Because quite honestly, some of the questions about AI are much larger than copyright. When you're talking about the survival of the human race, it's very hard to start to argue about, you know, name and likeness or that.
I've been saying I'm actually quite optimistic. I mean, I'm always cautiously optimistic, but I'm optimistic that we will find solutions to the copyright issues. Look, you know, I lived through, and many people in the room lived through, the period in the 90s where we had digital network technology, and then we had peer-to-peer streaming services, and people were saying copyright is dead. It is out of date. Young people don't respect it anymore. It simply can't be enforced in the internet. And you know what? We found ways forward. We now have more works available in more formats to more people than ever before. So I think we will find a solution to this. As to, you know, what AI means for the future of humanity, I'm probably slightly less optimistic. But luckily, that's not my job. But, you know, you raise important questions. The transparency issues, I think, are really important. The labeling issues are really important. We did ask questions about both of those also in our notice. And this is an area where, especially the transparency area, where there's a lot going on in the EU, and we're following that to see how that works out and what we can learn from it. But you raise a really important point, which is that some of these issues are not just copyright issues. So, for example, the digital likeness issues, those raise questions about consumer protection, and the FTC has been involved because there's been a lot of fraudulent use of digital likenesses. The Patent and Trademark Office is interested in part because of the copyright issues, but also because of the Lanham Act Section 43A issues. So that's an area where it's copyright is part of it, but not all of it. And then when it comes to transparency and labeling, those are even bigger issues. Those are issues that the White House is interested in, that the Commerce Department is interested in. It raises all kinds of questions about security and trust and just critical issues for society in addition to the copyright ones. So we need to make sure that we're all talking to each other and we think about how the copyright piece of it fits into the bigger whole.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been skeptical about the federal right of publicity because, as you know well, the copyright family doesn't necessarily agree on what to do. And the thing that our friends in Congress hate more than anything else is when we fight with each other, before we even get to fighting with, say, technology interests, it's very hard to do anything. But when it comes to transparency and record keeping, I've been optimistic because I felt that it aligns with larger goals of what is wanted by Congress out of AI, and that that's probably a good place for us to focus our efforts.
I mean, it's interesting. I think when you look at the 10,000 comments we got, which really came from all over the spectrum, and also we got nearly 100 comments from other countries, it was a very broad range of all the possible interests, including some very helpful comments that went into a lot of detail about how the technology works. But it's interesting to see that, I would say, in terms of people looking for legislative action, most of the comments had to do with the digital likeness issue, with the deepfakes issue. And there, I think, there's a lot of, as you say, disagreement over what that would look like and how you would deal with, for example, some of the First Amendment expressive use types of issues. On the copyright infringement side, I think there's a lot more reliance that we see in the comments on how existing law applies. And what we're seeing is that a lot of people say fair use is the appropriate rubric to analyze the questions. But of course, they have very different views on how fair use should be applied on these facts. And I imagine that as the litigations start to produce some court decisions in this area, if there's unhappiness with the direction that the courts are going, there's likely to be louder calls for legislation.
Right. And that's a great segue in that we've touched upon the policymaking in your office about the potential of legislation in Congress. But obviously, we now have a handful of cases, more than a handful. I made a chart once, and it was so busy that you couldn't show it because there were too many active cases. Are you watching those cases? Are there any in particular that you're more interested in the outcome in terms of what happens in the courts?
Yeah, we're watching all of them very closely. There's now almost 20 by our last count. A lot of them, as you know, are class actions. So they're big, potentially very big cases. The New York Times one is interesting in particular, perhaps because in that case, the facts looked like there was more output that was substantially or similar to or identical to actual input articles that have been input. So that seems slightly different. They're all different in certain ways. We're keeping up with them. We will be talking about them in the report. The government sometimes does weigh in on litigation once it gets to a stage where there's a clear policy issue at appellate level. So we'll see whether that happens in the future.
So selfishly, I have to dive into some music specific issues. You mentioned the Music Modernization Act. I think that what a lot of people don't recognize is that while you had almost complete unanimity of agreement on what to do in that legislation, it still almost didn't pass. It came probably 45 minutes from dying on the Senate floor, then passed unanimously, which is pretty remarkable. One of the things that the MMA did was create this new agency, the Mechanical Licensing Collective, or the MLC. And the legislation gave you authority, as you mentioned earlier, that you oversee that organization, and they have to actually be reauthorized. And we're in the middle of that process now. You obviously can't comment on the merit of that, but maybe just give a little bit of a understanding as to how that process works for designating this collective that performs this function.
Well, we, of course, designated them initially when the law first passed, and every 5 years we have to do a redesignation. So this is the first time this has happened. So we're still feeling our way and defining how the process will work. I expect we're going to keep getting a lot of input, which will be very helpful. I'm trying to think what else I can say, David, but
I didn't mean to put you in a box about it, but I guess
it has been very interesting. And I think, you know, we take very seriously our role in overseeing the operations of the MLC. We meet regularly with all the interested parties, with music publishers, with songwriters, with the MLC itself, with the digital license coordinator. And we want to make sure that we keep an eye on this and that it's operating smoothly and well and representing people appropriately. So stay tuned.
One of the other legislative successes of recent times was creating the Small Claims Court, which you mentioned earlier. Maybe tell us how you feel like that's going. Who are you seeing use the court in terms of from what area? And there was a lot of speculation about who would be taking advantage of it. Is that proven to be who actually is taking advantage of it? And where does it go in terms of, does it keep growing or do you feel like it's working, I guess?
I am so glad you're asking me about that. This is one of my favorite projects that we've done in the office. And in large part, I mean, I can't take credit for Congress passing the CASE Act and asking us to establish this. I wasn't there yet, but we did set up the court under my watch, and it's really been a great success. I know it's now been operating for about a year and 9 months. It has had over 700 claims. And we were very worried at first. We had no way of knowing whether either it would be inundated with claims so that we couldn't possibly keep up, or maybe there wouldn't be enough claims to stay busy because, as you probably know, respondents have the ability to opt out and to say they don't want to participate. So we thought everyone might opt out and say, we'll take our chance. We dare you to sue us in federal court. If you didn't want to do it before, you probably won't do it now. But that's not what's happened. We've had so far, I don't want to jinx anything, but about a 20% opt-out rate. There also was a lot of speculation that this tribunal, the Copyright Claims Board, would be used primarily by photographers. And photographers were very, very interested in having this opportunity. It's now about 40% works of visual art, including photographs, but musical works, motion pictures, virtually every kind of copyrighted work is now the subject of claims. And I think music is probably 15-20%, something like that, if you add sound recordings and musical works.
Which is even larger than probably we would have anticipated when the court launched.
I think that's right. The board has now issued about 20 decisions on the merits. They've been well received. We even had Plagiarism Today talk about how well considered and thoughtful and well researched and balanced their opinions have been. So I am extremely pleased with it. Just a couple of other interesting facts. About 70% of claimants are pro se, which is great. That's what Congress wanted, that people could come without lawyers to this tribunal. The percentage of respondents that are represented by a lawyer is a bit higher, which makes sense because they're being sued. More of them are corporations, so they're more likely to want to have lawyers. But it is going well. It's still early days, and we, of course, you know, are keeping a list of anything we might want to try to adjust or change in the future. But I have to say, I've been really pleased with how it's working.
I think that's been the reaction from the industry as well. There doesn't seem to be any downside to the option, and yet it gives an outlet for a lot of people that are maybe intimidated by the normal court system. So I think it's worked great.
One other interesting thing is that, so you can bring a claim of up to $30,000 in damages, but we also have an even more streamlined, smaller claims process for claims up to $5,000 in damages, and that's turned out to be extremely popular. And I think something like 40% of the claims are using the smaller claims procedure.
The other organization I want to ask about is the Copyright Royalty Board, which is within the Library of Congress. And there's a lot of, it's a complicated relationship that your office has with the Copyright Royalty Board. I'm not going to ask you anything controversial about it, but I do want to ask you about when Congress created this entity, the amount of money at stake has grown so much. But yet the resources of this, what is really a federal court-like system, hasn't grown with it. And I think a lot of participants in the system are concerned that it's being overwhelmed and that the judges don't have enough help, enough resources. And you end up with situations like songwriters did, where you can have a decision in January of 2018 and not actually have finality of that decision for 6 or 7 years. And that creates a real burden for small businesses like independent music publishers. And so do you think there's anything that Congress can be doing to basically support what they created so that the users of this system are ensured speedy justice?
Yeah, I know that's a concern. Of course, we've heard that. Just to say, if it's not something clear to everyone here, the CRB is not actually in the Copyright Office. So it's in the library, but we provide it with some administrative and budget support. We were able to get funding from Congress for the CRB to hire a couple of additional lawyers in the past year or so. So there has been some help provided. And I will say, I do think they had an unusual sort of collision of cases with a remand from the appellate court at the same time as they were deciding some new matters. So it hopefully was a combination of circumstances that won't normally occur again. But I do, you know, understand the concern.
Yeah. One of the remarkable things about your background is that you've had so much experience internationally, which has not always been the case of our registers. And you also have had so much experience in the private sector, which has not always been the case with our registers. I think many have come from academic backgrounds, which you also have, but you have this international and private sector experience that you bring to the job. I'd be curious what you've seen in other countries with how they deal with copyright issues that you'd like to see us learn from. And maybe the same thing, second part of the question, your experience in the private sector, where you've worked with very important, influential companies that have music copyrights or other copyrights. What can the government learn from how private sector does business that you think the government needs to appreciate?
Well, I do think it's interesting because in the United States, it's relatively easy for people to go back and forth between the private sector and government, and that's not true in most countries. And I think it's a real tremendous value add here because I know from my own experience and also some of my colleagues at the office, like our general counsel, who've had similar private sector backgrounds, it's so helpful when you're trying to, when you're listening to stakeholders, when you're trying to understand their concerns, when you're needing to make judgment calls about what to do and how to balance all these different interests. It's very helpful to know how it works in the boardroom, in the office, when creators are coming in. How do you translate what they do into a commercial product? How do you make sure that they get paid? How do you deal with this from a practical perspective? And then how do you translate that into what you tell to your government representatives when you're trying to ask for something? Being able to understand how that process works and to be able to interpret and apply and know that when you're making policy, you're not doing it from an academic, abstract point of view, that you know that it has real-world consequences and you'd better be able to understand them. because something could look beautiful on paper and just not work in the real world. Yeah.
So we're going to take questions from the audience after I ask this final question so you can all start to ponder on what you might want to ask. Final question for you is, I see a lot of students in the room, including a few that actually were in my class last semester at NYU. What advice would you give to college students who are obviously interested in doing something in the field of copyright, or they wouldn't be here? You know, you've had this wide range of experience, and as they look to their futures, you know, what would you tell these students?
Well, I usually give advice to law students on careers in copyright. And I think that advice is probably fairly transferable. I think mostly you need to take opportunities, find out about opportunities and take opportunities. And I know in my career, I never had a career plan from the beginning to the end. I didn't think, you know, 30 years ago, I want to someday be the head of the copyright office. But everything I did taught me something new, changed me in some way, and opened my eyes to some new opportunity. And I took those new opportunities even when they meant having to learn something different, like taking a challenge, having to do something I'd never done before and maybe made me a little bit nervous. And I think that's just great career advice for anyone. And then in terms of getting into the copyright world, so much of it, I mean, I see that in this room here. I see so many people I knew when I practiced law in the late 80s and, you know, when I was at Time Warner in the 2000s. It is really great. People talk about networking, but I don't even mean like deliberate networking where you're calling people and saying, can I get to know you? Participating in things, coming to events like this, joining organizations, going to the Copyright Society. There is nothing like getting to know people who work in the field so you can see what they do, so they can get to know you, so you can find out what's out there. I just think there's no substitute for that.
Well, for anyone that's interested in going into a field that involves copyright, you owe a great debt of gratitude to this woman who does so much to ensure that those opportunities exist by protecting what is copyright. And so I want to thank you for doing this interview and really appreciate you being here.
There you have it. Thank you to United States Copyright Office Register Shira Perlmutter and NMPA President David Israelite. This Musonomics Live podcast of the Ralph S. Peer Lecture was produced by Dishib Garg. Thanks to Peer Music and thanks to Luminate for their support of the pod. Special thanks to Dean Jack Knott, Julie Freyer, Ben Oriel, Mary Park, Zara Maida, Mauro Miller, and Rose Hernandez. From the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt, I'm Larry Miller. Thanks for listening.